Violence per se has never been my bag, except personally. But in pictures, it has, and I would like to try to at least portray it on the screen as it is. I've failed, and I've succeeded. But of all those pictures you talk about, basically are morality plays. I've broken a lot of fences and noses. I just do the best kind of a job I know how. But there are certain people who are filmmakers, and there are certain people who are not, that's all.
Hey, it's season 9 of perhaps one of your favorite podcasts, The Good, The Pod, The Ugly. This is New Jack, like regular Jack, but fewer calories.
Uh-huh. Yeah, this is Ken.
Oh, yeah, co-host Ken, and this is our 4x4 redo? Yeah, 4x4x2 season, where we bring on guests to help us pick the four directors, four films that we'll be covering. And this week, we have Eric. Welcome, Eric.
Hey, Eric. Hello. Hey, thank you for inviting me to New Jack City. Ho-ho! Yeah.
All right. You can edit that out there. Hey, so Eric, you are one of our favorite guests, and you've been on many times before. And it took you a bit to pick your director. And if you don't know the 4x4, like Thomas said, we're having four guests pick a director, and four of their films they feel are emblematic of either the director's style or covers an arc of their career. And Eric, you chose
Sergio Martino, which puts me completely on brand.
So tell us, why you chose him, and then maybe a little bit about him, because a lot of people may not be familiar with him or his work.
So Sergio Martino, Italian film director, and did a lot of giallo films. He also did a couple of westerns, but you know, he made a lot of his name primarily doing a lot of the Italian giallo films. And a lot of people, if they know what Italian giallo is, they immediately think of Dario Argento. They immediately think of Mario Bava, Lucio Fulci. So those are like the three godfathers of the genre. And then there are some directors that are like on the periphery, like Sergio Martino, who did some really good work. And I feel like film aficionados know who they are. But for the average person who is not just, you know, bathed in trying to learn a lot about giallo, I think Sergio Martino is a really good one to sort of bring out, because his work is it goes from very accessible to a little on the edge. So it's an interesting journey when you start diving into his work.
Great. So what you're trying to say is you wanted us to have fewer listeners than Designated Mourner.
I was surprised that out of the four movies you picked, I had seen three of them before. I never knew they were from the same director. They were just giallos, probably with Edwidi Finesse. And I had seen them before. And before we go any further, we should say trigger warning. Both the genre and the films we're covering today do have numerous instances of assault, attempted assault, and outright rape. It's an unfortunate part of the giallo genre, but it's all there.
What is the giallo genre? As a person who knows Asia and her dad did some of these films, I thought going into this and knowing Eric that these were going to be horror, suspense, supernatural films.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Thomas.
Yeah.
Because I asked ChatGPT, I think that's what it's called. I don't know what it's called. To give a brief summation of the genre of giallo, told in the voice of Krusty the Clown. I'm not going to do his voice, but I'll read you what ChatGPT spit out. Hey, 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 kids. It's Krusty the Clown here to talk to you about giallo films. Now, giallo is an Italian film genre that started in the 60s and 70s. These movies are usually murder mysteries with a lot of suspense, gore, and stylish cinematography. The killer often wears black gloves and uses sharp weapons like knives to do the dirty work. The stories usually involve some kind of twist ending or surprise reveal of the killer's identity. It's a bit like a murder mystery mixed with a horror movie. So if you like blood, guts, and intrigue, check out some giallo films, but don't watch them alone at night. Ha ha ha. Thank you, Krusty the Clown.
Yeah, I don't think AI is going to replace us anytime soon.
If I had done it in the voice, maybe. But that would be all me. You can't spell
giallo without AI.
That's true.
There is a pretty piss poor documentary on AMC Plus called All the Colors of Giallo. Mm-hmm. I didn't learn much from it, but it is there for the viewing.
Oh, yeah, they released that. That was made, and it was released with All the Colors of the Dark, which was a box set that was put out, I believe, by Severin. A lot of it's in Italian, especially the interviews. And it has some interesting stuff, and I think that's the one with the interview with Sergio Martino, where he talks about
it. It is. The last 15 minutes of it, they dedicated to him.
He talks about the rules of the genre, and I think that's pretty interesting.
There was also a documentary, a long one, I remember, was kind of looked cheap, but it was about Italian genre films of the 70s, mm-hmm. included giallo, their crime films, their women in cages, the sex comedies in particular. I forget what that was called, but that was one that I watched when it came out like 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting period in Italian filmmaking because they were aping a lot of American films, and they were shooting a lot of films in Italy and around that region, but trying to make it look like they were set in the United States. Like Pieces is another one that's by a Spanish film director, and they're trying to make it look like Boston. And it's clearly not friggin' Boston. But so there was a real attempt to court American audiences by casting American actors. Mm-hmm. And then also trying to make them look like they were taking place in America. Demons is another one.
Demons is
one that uses a lot of Americanisms in there to try and make it appealing to American audiences. So, yeah, it's a really interesting period. The Westerns, the spy thrillers. And then they got into these futuristic post-apocalyptic gladiator movies for a while as you get into the late 70s and the mm-hmm. early 80s. They're a lot of fun, because they're bootstrapping all this stuff just to put it together. It's kind of an ocean to, when you delve into the history as far as what they were doing, they had a very robust film industry.
Now I've watched a lot of giallos. I think I was introduced to them by you, not like personally introduced. And they're like usually an hour and a half long. They're dumb fun. They're ridiculous. But you have kind of become a connoisseur to the degree that you have actually written like updated modern day type giallo film scripts.
Yeah.
So you've internalized a lot of the rules that you were talking about with Martino.
Yeah. What's interesting is that when you look back at some of the films that we grew up on, like some of De Palma's earlier work, then you're getting the idea of where De Palma was influenced. A lot of people always say Hitchcock, which that's true, but there's a lot of stuff that De Palma used in some of that 70s work, like Blowout and things like that, that are definitely inspired by giallo films. Same thing for Joe Ezra Haas with Basic Instinct. There's a lot of giallo influences in there. And a lot of these guys, you know, were probably seeing these movies, Times Square, you know, and then the 60s, the 70s. When they used to run movies, you know, 24 hours a day. And it's really interesting to see the influence of Italian film directors on American directors, especially during that, you know, what I call the Raging Bulls and era, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls era, because they were also being influenced by the French New Wave, but also when there was some of the Italian work as well.
Okay. So do you want to get in a little bit to the strange vice of Mrs. Ward?
Yeah. Yeah, we have two films this week. Both start with the title, or have Vice in the title.
Vice Week! Woo!
Actually, both have serial killers that die before the final act. Spoiler.
Mm-hmm.
They have dirt bikes in both. There's mm-hmm. Peeping Toms, sexless marriages, and Well, I'm pretty sure there's boobs in both.
A lot of points for the boobs.
Yeah, one in particular, though, the first one we're talking about, The Strange Vice of Mrs. Ward.
Ward.
Which stars possibly the actress who's most associated with the genre, am I pronouncing it right, Edwidge Finch?
I think it's just Edwidge Finch.
Edwidge Finch, okay.
Yes.
Yeah, very, very much the actress most associated with this genre. She was in a ton of them, and she was in... Well, the two that we're talking about this week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So The Strange Vice of Miss Ward is 1971, and it's a great year for movies, for the podcast at least, because you have Clint Eastwood's first directed movie. And Dirty Harry.
Uh-huh.
You have Duel, Spielberg's first. And it's also, unfortunately, the year that the last movie John Ford ever directed came out. And Carnal Knowledge by Nichols.
Okay. Written by Pulitzer Prize winning cartoonist Jules Pfeiffer.
So this is my first viewing, but it sounds like you might have seen it before, Ken.
I have. This is probably... this is the one I always think of when I think of Giallo and Edwidge Finch. Because... it is ridiculous. Some of it is has not aged well, but by the time it gets to the end, it's one of my favorites just because I think the plot is so nuts, but at the same time, it kind of all makes sense by the time you get to the end, and we're going to spoil it, that I always think this is one of the most delightful of the giallos I've seen.
Yeah. So this one is, it's interesting for me. It's not my favorite of all the giallos. But it's probably the most straightforward, even though it has a ridiculously convoluted plot that makes absolutely no sense when you get to the end. And this is the problem with giallo sometimes, is that they get a little too cute by half. And so, I mean, the general plot here is that an American diplomat's wife is being stalked by an ex-abusive lover. And then Jean, and yeah, played by the always awesome Ivan Rasimov, and they go back to Italy, and because he's a foreign diplomat, and when they come back, there's this serial killer that is killing women randomly, typically prostitutes, I think, is the implication, and so she's being stalked by this ex abusive lover, and then at the same time, it could be this psycho serial killer who's killing people with a straight razor, which they make sure to tell us. And at the same time, you have George Hilton, who is also a giallo favorite. He's probably in almost every friggin' giallo movie, who shows up as a love interest. And gosh, maybe it could be him.
George.
So the plot, there's a lot of whodunit aspect going on, like who could it be, who's harassing her, and what have you. And it's, I guess we're spoiling. So it essentially just becomes like a riff on Strangers on a Train.
A bit like Scream.
Yes.
The first one.
Yeah.
Eric, your synopsis just now, almost perfectly 1 minute, which is a new feature for these 4x4s. Congrats, sir.
I do not have to read out the ChatGPT plot to this movie as spoken by Samuel L. Jackson. Thank you, Eric.
You're welcome. So, yeah, so this is actually put out under a couple titles. Actually, I think three. Was the original Italian title, which is La Strano Visio Delia Signora Ward. And then there's, of course, The Strange Vice of Mrs. Ward. It was also released under the name Blade of the Ripper. And then it was also released under one called Next. And then it was called Next Victim. And this is because of regional releases. They try to figure out what title is going to work best in whichever region they're releasing it in. And sometimes they're just trying to make cheap money by just putting a new name on it.
Yeah. Hey, there's a new movie playing down at the Bijou. And then 15 minutes, wait a second. Haven't we already seen this?
And so Troll 3.
and they got me because I saw this as when I bought the DVD, Blade of the Ripper. And then they did, I can't remember if this was a Severin release, but then they released it as under its original title, Strange Vice of Miss Ward. I'm like, oh, cool. It's another Edward Finch movie. And I order it. And I'm like, wait, I've seen this fucking movie. So they got my money twice. Well, actually three times, because I did buy the box Blu-ray.
This was made in a different time. They were a little bit more promiscuous and open about it back then, at least in the Italian movies. They ask at one point if the husband is modern, because it's okay that she's sleeping around with Georges.
Yeah, so these movies are actually it's an interesting debate, because so there's a great, excellent journalist, film journalist. Her name is Rachel Nisbet. You can find her on Twitter. She actually does some stuff for these Blu-ray releases of giallos. And she typically focuses on color palette, sets, the buildings used, a lot of the setting and things like that. And she and I had a very interesting conversation. And these movies are actually very progressive for the most part. When it comes to sexuality, a lot of the women are very sexually independent. They're very sexually empowered. There's a lot of LGBT stuff in these movies. There's some in Deep Red that our Dario Argento did. And so they're very, very progressive, even with some of the other stuff that's going on in these movies, which can be seem a little misogynistic. As you talked about some of the rape stuff, like this film, I believe, has a scene that kind of crosses into that Straw Dogs controversial territory. When
the Jean, opening, right?
Well, it's when Jean, yeah, when Jean, well, there's two. So there's the opening, you know, scene where they're arguing in the car, the opening flashback, and it's pouring rain, and like Edward gets out, runs out of the car, and Jean gets out and tracks her down. And I can't remember if he hits her or not, but then, you know, their clothes eventually come off, and then they're having sex in the rain on the ground. And then there's another flashback sequence where he breaks a bottle and all the shards of glass land on her naked body. And then he lays on top of her and they're having sex. And when she was originally resistant, then she's like into it. Mm-hmm. And so that's this little Straw Dogs kind of controversial thing that I think it kind of slips into. But I think what they're going for was they're trying to illustrate the dynamics of an abusive relationship.
So that opening scene in the rain, my wife, she likes these movies, all right. But as soon as that came up, she got up and said, I don't know why these fucking movies always have to have rape in it. And then she left the room, which is fair.
Yeah. The way rape was treated in cinema for a long time is very different than how we look at it now. So you have to look at these things. You can look at these things through the lens of now, and then you can look at them at the same time. You can look at them in the period that they were shot in and sort of get an idea of why that was. We considered. I mean, and movies just use as an ultimate threat for the most part. But these films, it's definitely a little different, because again, there's that moment where she's resistant and then she's into it, and that's where it gets a little weird.
I guess one of the things I watched this dubbed.
Me too.
And also, ooh, they had a VHS version on the streaming that I had, so that's what I ended up watching. Vice is an homonym, so like I couldn't remember if vice was like gambling, other addictive properties, or if it was like she was gonna crush somebody's head. I was really hoping it was the second thing.
She has a blood fetish, Thomas.
Yeah. And so what I guess I was reading into that relationship was that she's a little spooked by him, thinks that he might be the killer. But she did spend 2 years with him, right, prior to her husband. And so the strange vice is that, is my understanding, would be her backstory.
Okay, I thought it was her blood fetish. But going back to the very problematic rapey stuff, narratively, by the end of the movie, all three of the men who have been conspiring pretty much against her from before the movie even starts, they all get theirs. So there is a bit of triumphalism of those men doing that. She finally gets to fuck them over.
They're Eskimo brothers, aren't they? I don't know if that works the other way around. I've always heard of Eskimo sisters, but yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, there's catharsis for her, but it's a weird muted catharsis because at the end of everything, so when everything is revealed that George Hilton and the dude who plays her husband were in it together to kill her, and then because there's another character in here that's part of this, and that's her name is Carol, and she's played by the always amazing Christina Araldi, and she is a relative of George Hilton's character. Their uncle has just died. So they both stand to inherit quite a bit of money. So so the strangers on a train dynamic is that Edward Finesse's husband is having George Hilton kill Edward Finesse, and then Edward Finesse's husband is supposed to kill Carol, which he does.
It makes sense.
And they're going to blame it on this serial killer who's running around town killing prostitutes with a straight razor.
But to set it up properly, Eric, I think if you haven't seen this film, that happens in the last 10 minutes of the film. You find that out. That's yes. Also after a locked room mystery yes. And with an ice cube and a lot of, yeah, extramarital stuff and a vacation and harpoon shooting a fish
that does not pay off.
It does not.
Don't show me a harpoon if no one's gonna get shot by it, man.
So this is the thing. So this is where they get a little too cute by half. I mean, so this is supposed to be a simple crisscross scenario. There's absolutely no reason whatsoever for George to become romantically involved with Edward Finesse in this movie. Unless he was like, hey, wait a minute, dude, your wife's really hot. Can I throw a couple shots in before we do this? I mean, because you know, and that's the other thing, too. I mean, this is like the fatal attraction problem. Like, no one's, you know, cheating on, Ann Archer with Glenn Close. Sorry, that's just the reality. So, is there a dude who's really going to have his wife, Edwidge Finesse, killed for fucking insurance money? I just don't see it. But, you know, but that's me. But there's absolutely no reason whatsoever for him to become involved with Edwidge Finesse and for them to drag this whole cat and mouse thing out. And in fact, it actually works against them because the entire time they're wanting to blame it on the serial killer. And while they're doing this cat and mouse bullshit that they absolutely don't have to do, the fucking guy gets caught and killed that's running around killing these women. And so they're like, oh, fuck, what are we going to do? And then comes the suicide, stage suicide with the ice cube in the lock, which is actually a kind of a cool little scene. Yeah, so this is the problem with some of these gyals is they get so convoluted in the cat and mouse stuff and, you know, the fun and games that we like to call it, that it really ultimately doesn't make sense. But they're so pulpy and entertaining, you kind of just let them get away with it, even though it doesn't make sense.
And there are things like their apartment in Vienna is totally retro future amazing, where yeah. The walls have these, like, half cut out giant soda can uh-huh. bubbles on them. And then they go to a party where ladies are wearing dresses made out of paper and they just get into a fight where they're naked.
One of whom goes home is dropped killed. Off and you're like, oh, well, she's going to die. And yeah, she does. But what's uh-huh. amazing is this. Then later you get the stewardess who comes home. And you're like, oh, she's definitely going to die. And instead, she kills the serial killer, right?
Yeah, it's the cab driver from the first scene in the movie.
Yep.
Who has this amazing leap. Look for that gif coming out. Because he's like a cat just jumping, leaping into frame. That was truly a moment in cinema where I was like, I'm really glad that this exists. It made a lot... Versus also whenever she's getting chased in the basement, I couldn't really understand what the letters were for the elevator, but wherever she's going to, even though she never drives and can't drive, presumably, well, I guess she can because she's driving when they're on vacation, but she doesn't like have a car is my understanding whenever she's in Vienna, but she's down in the car lot or the underground the parking, and she's being chased, and she gets in a car, and she drives it like 10 yards, like 12 meters, to get out and go to the elevator. Why don't just drive over the guy or leave? But no, right. She uses the car to expedite going to the elevator, and then the elevator is about to close, and the guy almost gets her, and then, yeah.
And then she goes up to her husband, and then somebody's coming up the stairs, and then it turns out it's just like a dude. And he goes like, as much as the elevators don't work here, I consider this a walk-up. And it's like, oh, phew.
That is like a staple of giallo movies. The elevators never fucking work. That's actually,
well, it's Italy, right? Well, it's just, it's in Austria. They should be working. It should be working in Vienna.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's a plot device in the very first giallo film that I actually watched understanding what I was watching, which is The Case of the Bloody Iris. Like, the elevator never works, and it's actually a plot device in the movie. And I just figure, like, we really can't cram the camera in an elevator. We're just going to use the stairs.
So I want to talk about the scene where they go to Jean's, I think it's Jean's, and he apparently has a menagerie of animals.
I'll grant you this, Ken, but I need to talk about tits. So,
okay. All right. Well, I was going to say that the animals in his apartment, it's almost the Unforgiven of animal jump scares, because you got lizards, you got birds, you got whatever the hell else is up there. Every time they turn around, something makes a noise and she gasps, and then it's like, oh, phew. And then it turns out he faked his death in the bathtub.
Well, you don't find that out at that point, right? You see, that's when you see him that he's dead. And then only later do you find out that he, I guess, isn't. But yeah, she has also that weird flashback where she's on vacation and there's the dripping. And so she remembers John killing himself, but really it's just the radiator. That's a nice touch. Like the rust on the radiator dripping that looks like blood.
That is a one shitty radiator.
There's a moment. Right before the flight attendant comes home, which I don't think she gets topless. Almost everybody, any woman in this, if she's on screen and not talking for more than like 2.5 minutes, her top's coming off. It's like a Andy Sedaris film from the 80s. And there's actually a moment after, right before that flight attendant comes in, where I'm like, man, I started to clock it. It's been like 19 minutes since I've seen a pair of breasts on screen. And then boom, there they were. So I was happy, I guess. But there was like, you can almost set your watch by how much a woman is without a top in this first film. And for gratuitously no good reason most of the time.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a moment where for some reason, Finch and her friend Carol are talking, and Carol's just like finishing up a bath, and they're talking from the doorway. So she gets up and, you know, very, very, yeah, very, very slim pretext for getting somebody with their top off.
That's actually one of my favorite scenes, because she gets out of the bathtub and she puts on a poncho without the top off.
Uh-huh.
Every time I see this movie, I'm like, I still don't understand why she's putting on a poncho instead of drying off. Is this how she dries off? It's weird. But yeah, one of the things, though, is that about giallo films is I really love the costume design of the period. Like, so after Carol gets out of the bathtub and she does the poncho thing, she puts on this blouse shirt, and it's got this crisscross front. Yeah, it's like an open front, so it's obviously showing a lot of cleavage. But it's got this crisscross design going on. And there's a lot of that kind of costuming in these movies. And it's just very interesting to me from a style standpoint, like of the period, of the time. Of course, it's a lot of boots. I think it's, she's probably wearing boots almost in every single scene of this movie. I know she is in the next one. So the costume design in these movies, I always find very interesting. Sort of like the paper dresses you were talking about earlier.
Uh-huh.
There's always something kind of unique about the costume design of these. And I'm just wondering if that's because they're in the hub of a fashion, you know, where they're making these movies.
Now, do you guys buy that her friend, the soon-to-be heiress, the cousin of George, who wears the poncho out of the tub, would go in her place to the park where
no.
you have a good jump scare?
She's very modern.
Yes, she's very modern.
But also, even though she goes, like, then they have to, how do they know to kill her there, right? Because they weren't trying to kill.
And clearly they would know it wasn't her.
But she's supposed to die anyway.
Okay, so it's just a bonus.
It's just a bonus, yeah. So it makes no sense other than like, well, I'm going to help my friend out to see what's going on. So it makes sense in that way, because she's convinced this Jean doing it. So that's one of the reasons why she decides to go. And it's like, okay, this is probably Jean. And when he shows up, I'm going to laugh in his face. I think that's her actual line. But since Edwidge's husband is supposed to kill Carol, yes, it makes no sense that he knows ahead of time that Carol's going to go. The only way it works is that if you think Carol's in on what's going on, and then the surprise is that, oops, she's not, she gets killed. So that's the only way that scene like works or makes any sense.
Yeah, she seems like, it's like this kind of, not cruel, just cruel digits. What's the origin of that I want? Dangerous liaisons that but they're cousins, where it seems like she's really trying to get her, she's like really into her cousin, but instead wants our protagonist to have sex with him. In that restaurant scene, they eat apples. Who the fuck eats an apple at a restaurant?
It's Italy, 1971. Cigarettes.
No, it's Vienna. Wine, but yes,
Vienna, and yeah. So there is one of the scenes that I thought was amazing was when she's brought to the police station. I think it's after her friend Carol gets killed, and then she has a successive meeting as she's leaving with all three of the men, and all three of the men, they barely acknowledge the other person. It's almost like she walks forward and there's another one and they say something. And then she walks to the other one. And the other scene is when she faints and has a nightmare and she wakes up from her husband saying, "Julie, wake up. I developed that photo." For some reason I had to pause it cause I was laughing so hard.
So that's actually one of the shot you're talking about. It's actually something I made a note about, because in this particular movie, so this was shot, Emilio Forescott, and it's very economical, this movie, as far as what their setups. They do a lot with a single setup, and that scene is actually a great example of it, because she's talking with the cops, her husband shows up, and then, you know, there's a slight little pause in their dialogue, and I believe you see Jean cross in the background, and George is there, and then, so it's very economical, and he does that throughout the entire film. Mm-hmm. So there's not a lot of dynamic camera movement here. So, I mean, giallos are usually really well known for really high innovative camera work. You don't see a lot of that here in this particular movie. It's kind of static. It's really straightforward.
Oh, there is one scene though, where she, the radiator, remembers the blood, and the camera starts doing crazy things around her before she passes out. Amazing scene.
Yeah. So that's one that stands out. But the rest of it, there's not a lot of dynamic stuff going on.
Yeah. There's almost a breaking of the 180 where like they turn the camera, I guess it's a steady cam. Maybe they have it on a track and it goes like almost a full crescent around her and then back again.
Yeah.
So there's some fun stuff camera wise, and like you said, Eric, it looks good. The style, even when the style is atrocious, it's still definitely statements.
He loves his POV driving shots, which I love as well.
Yeah, that's a very 70s staple, isn't it? Mm-hmm. it's also scored by Nora Arlandi, and the score works really well here as well. She also scored Johnny Yuma, so she's she did, I think she did like 20, 30 films, something like that.
Oh, okay.
So after watching this film, I asked my wife, who sat through it all with me, how problematic was like the fetishization of boobs, but also just like some of the sexual violence? I think much like Eric, she's like, you know, it's of the time. But her biggest complaint was that every time she has a crisis, our protagonist has a crisis, the man rushes off to fix the problem instead of just sticking around and keeping her company, which is all that she really needed.
Well, see, that's what I, so I felt like there was a missed opportunity here, and they, you know, again, it would probably still be a little cute by half, but if at the end, so at the end of this movie, she ends up finding a new fella, right? The doctor, yeah. Uh-huh. The young doctor who saved her life at the very end. And she's like, you know, I just don't know who I am anymore. And he's like, well, you know, one thing I know that heals everything is time. And there's just a look between them. And, you know, it's obvious that she's found a new guy.
That sheet CPR was pretty sexy.
So I kind of thought it would have been cool if, like, well, let's do a double reversal. Maybe she clued into their bullshit early on and she set all this up. And now she's getting the insurance payout. And maybe she was like an executor of Carol's will or something like that. Or she was, you know, down to some sort of a third beneficiary in the event of both their deaths. Then that would have been great.
Could have gone on forever.
Yeah.
And then it turns out the doctor was ahead of her the whole time. And he, yeah, then you just keep going on and on and on.
You could just keep going. So, but yeah, I mean, it's, you know, ultimately, this movie is, it's a lot of fun, even if it doesn't make, you know, the plot doesn't make a lick of sense because it's way too convoluted. Uh-huh. And the cast of characters that are in this movie, I mean, they're all pretty much in every single, damn near every single Giallo movie. Made. It's almost like American Horror Story, right? Where they keep using the same cast over and over, uh-huh. over again. So I think, you know, these, especially these Martina movies, because he likes to work with the same actors, you know, it's kind of the same thing. They're just, you know, although George Hill pretty much played the same character in every friggin' movie.
Yeah. Is he the one that, speaking of modern, the belted white leather jacket with tassels early on in the film that he wears?
Oh, yeah.
I'm a big fan of turtlenecks in Italian giallos, but he couldn't even pull that thing off. he looked like a barfly from rural Oregon.
He's a good-looking man, though. I could see why he got a lot of work. He was definitely like a leading man charisma.
And he could carve a G into an apple like nobody.
Thomas, did you enjoy this? I'm not getting a read on your feelings.
It's hard to say. Like, it's hard to recommend as a film. I do think I like it better than like Nightmare City. I think is one giallo that I saw, which is more of a zombie movie. Like, I think I mm-hmm. like the crime version of these better than the supernatural version of these.
Gotcha.
And so to that degree. I think I'm more on board with this.
Okay. Are we ready for some internet reviews?
Sure.
Okay. This is from Letterboxd. And this is from Team Gal. I don't know if that's Gal Gadot or not. Gives it 2 stars and says, "The strange vice of Mrs. Ward evidently is codependency. Bitch can't go 5 minutes without a man." Fair.
Yeah.
Someday I will. Oh, this is from Jack, not our Jack, but a different Jack. 2 stars. "Someday I will finally accept giallo is not for me and stop trying to enjoy it. But today was not that day." Okay. Sorry, Jack. And JD gives it 3 stars and says, "Moral of the story, men are the worst." No, really. Men are the worst. Also pretty fair. I got one more that might be from Eric. It's really short. It's 4 stars from Danny. "Edwidge Finesh is one of the greatest icons of the 70s. And in fact, she is the 70s. Is that you, Eric?
That person knows their fucking giallo. I'm going to tell you that right now.
Uh-huh. What do you got for us, Thomas?
Let me see. This is coming in kind of hot. Brad Holland, a year ago, "If a movie showed Hillary Clinton being told in advance about the attacks on Benghazi while she was having sex with a young male aide, and she responded, 'I'm busy right now, remind me later,' it would just be described as reprehensible to make up such assumptions and present them as facts. Vice is a movie." Oh, this is about, okay, this is a different, this is 2018 Vice. Never mind. We'll keep going, guys.
So did you guys pick up that one of the shots in this movie sets up the next one?
I got confused that one of the mini flowers that she gets with the notes is the title of the next movie.
It is, yes.
Which I was like, wait, which movie are we watching? I thought, that, and it seems to be the only reason for the title was that they were like, that's kind of a cool title. We should, if we can't ever think of a title for something, we'll just use that.
Yeah, so it's actually the same writer for both films.
But then this next one, which, can you give us the full title, Eric?
The full title is Your Vice is a Locked Room and Only I Have the Key.
Pretty good title. And this came out, what, a year or two after the previous film?
1972. So a year after.
So think about, writing credits on Italian films get really convoluted and weird. It's like they're just handing them out, you know, like flyers in the mall. Sometimes it's like, hey, you know what? It's like they're all at the vineyard, you know, they're having a meeting. They've been there for 6 hours and, you know, talking, eating prosciutto and drinking some vino. They're like, hey, I got an idea. Here's how you should do that scene. Great. You get a writing credit and you get a writing credit and the waiter gets a writing credit. And it's, so
is that really how you imagine the Italian film industry was? That you know, sounds amazing.
Because these guys worked on each other's. It's really this great sense of filmmaking community between these guys. They all worked on each other's films, and they tried to be like so grateful for any, you know, sort of like input that they would just throw your name, give you some kind of a credit. And it's actually this great sense of community. I think it's kind of cool. But trying to figure out who's responsible for what is sometimes really difficult. But so the writer of Vice Locked Room is Ernesto Gastaldi, and he worked with Martino quite a few times, and he also did work on Strange Vice of Ms. Ward. So that note when she gets with the flowers, the actual note says, "I know you're trying to get away from me, but your vice is like a room locked from the inside, and only I have the key."
Ah.
And then he takes that, then he manipulates that into the title of the next film.
Which, doesn't it, this next film have also an Edgar Allan Poe component?
Yes, it's based on The Black Cat. And so I think this is a better film. And it's it takes a radical stylistic jump from Ward. It's the visuals are very different because it's actually shot by Giancarlo Ferrando, and the movies that he did with Sergio are all very visually different and far more impressive than Miss Ward. So you have him working with a lot of the same people over and over again, and you can definitely tell the difference when he doesn't work with those people.
So you want to give a shot at the plot?
Yeah, so let me see if I can get this in a minute.
are you timing him, Thomas?
I'm all about right, to, yeah.
All right. Okay, come on, Eric. I have faith. Go for it.
All right. So Your Vice is a Locked Room and Only I Have the Key follows the story of a failed writer and an alcoholic. Those are both the same thing. And who has an Oedipus complex for his dead mother, and he takes it out on his wife and anyone else who's around him, and he may even be a murderer.
Wow. That was
you still
good.
Have 36 seconds. You haven't mentioned a cat, a bottle collector, a ancestral relationship.
The dirt bike race, man.
The dirt bike race and all that. And so here's the other thing, too, is that watching these two films back to back, you see two starkly different performances by Edward Furnish. Very different performances, which can kind of tells you her range a little bit. You know, in Strange Vice and Miss Ward, she's very meek and she's kind of afraid of everything. And here she plays like a manipulative puppet master, and mm-hmm. she does it really, really well.
When he calls her a two-bit slut and she just takes it and says, that would be two bits well spent.
I wrote that down.
Yeah. Probably the best line in the movie.
Oh yeah. Where she just calls up, just straight out calls him out on his relationship with his mother. Is it true you slept with your mother when you were already grown up, I mean? is a true
Yeah, YouTube like it's okay in Italy if it's if it happens when you're younger. It's but you're not mentioning Anita what is her name? Strindberg?
Anita Strindberg.
Which probably the only actress whose cheekbones would be just as dangerous as some of the knives in these movies.
Yes,
probably the sharpest cheekbones I have ever seen in a movie is her in this one.
And I'm not very good with ages or faces, but I'm assuming that she's an older woman because of the comments that the kids in town say about not minding getting a little salt and pepper on their pecker.
Oh,
yeah.
No, that's a racial thing.
Oh.
Oh.
So, because they're touch that. So they have the housekeeper who is black. And so they're talking about like, so the dudes in town are talking about that they want to get with the black housekeeper in addition to the wife.
Oh, okay. And that's what they're thinking. I mean, that's what the author's doing, presumably, if he wasn't impotent.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Oh, I didn't catch that. I thought it was an age thing about.
And instead, it's even worse.
Great. Oh, I'm glad I brought that up.
Yes. So no, it's a racial thing. So I mean, they refer to her multiple times in ways that we would now consider to be quite offensive.
Well, I think in the time as well, because the hippies stick up for her, right?
They do. They start singing that "Free Yourself" song. So,
daughter, open your eyes, daughter.
Yeah, so, I don't think we have the copyright for that. We gotta probably have to edit that down a little bit. Okay. I can't believe you did the whole song there, Ken. Jack, trim it down to less than 10 seconds, please.
Thomas, you're a crummy slut.
Yeah, so this whole thing with the Edgar Allan Poe angle, I mean, it's really loose. I mean, the Black Cat really, I mean, at its core is about excess hedonism and alcoholism, and it's a warning, and this film really like dives into that, because he's got those hippies there at the beginning, and this is something that Martino did a couple times. He does it here, and he does it in one of the movies we'll talk about later, where there's a really leans into the hippie element of the time period.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in the other one, it's really hedonistic. There's these multiple parties.
Yeah.
And that's clearly what this guy is doing. He's inviting the hippies down to get drunk with them. And, they're always taking their clothes off, as hippies are wont to do. And it really is sort of this foray into just his total breakdown, because apparently he was a good writer. Now he's not, since his mom died. And just drinking hand over fist and doesn't really know what to do with himself. And he continues to abuse his wife publicly and privately. And there's a plot thing that's introduced later when Edward Finesse shows up that really kind of comes out of nowhere about the family jewels. Right? That this turns into like a heist movie at some point.
So the hippies are camping in the woods at a place they call the Worldwide Campground. It is never explored more than just explained as that, and them being there at the beginning, and then they show up once more and he says, go away. That's pretty much it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, then later on, it plays a huge, huge role in one of the other films that I picked.
Okay.
Yeah, so this was written by Ernesto Gastaldi, shot by Giancarlo Ferrando, and all the visuals here just take this huge, huge leap here. So in that opening party scene with the hippies, there's this wonderful shot where they're all on the couch, and once they stand up, the girl starts to stand up to start to dance after they start that Free Yourself song, the camera just kind of like lifts up a little bit, and suddenly we're pulling across the length of the dining table. And it's an elongated table, and it's like this quick pullback, and it's a little disorienting, but it's great because it just suddenly reveals, the breadth of the room and how many people are in there. And it just right away, you can just tell that there's someone else, handling the visuals here than what you see in Ward. And it's really, you see a lot of that dynamic camera movement in this movie.
I think visually this movie is obviously very interesting compared to the previous one and of a piece. I think my problems with this one is that I don't have a problem with main characters who are terrible. I just found the trio, and it really becomes almost a three-hander, are so profoundly unlikable. I really didn't care about any of the consequences or who was doing what. In fact, each time I've watched this movie, when the actual killer is revealed, it's like some random guy, I think. And each time I'm like, I don't really care who that is. I don't even think Martino is very interested in the kill scenes in this. He seems more interested in the nihilistic alcoholic writer. That's all the same thing. Unable to write, and just his noxious relationship with his wife. And she is just as noxious. And it turns out she was planning to kill him with some guy who looks like a Ken doll with a gray wig. I'm not even sure who that guy is.
So the thing that I guess I don't, as you're talking about a kid, there's a scene where after the husband's dead, I believe, there's the typewriter going off. And it must be the killer, Jean from the other movie, but wearing white Barbie Ken hair. But he types, what does he type? Like retribution or no, revenge? What does he type?
Vengeance or vendetta. That's it.
Over and over again. Like, I don't know. Alan Moore.
No playmate. Jack a dull boy.
Yeah, I just didn't get how he had spent that much time there with them only hearing it towards the end. But also, why? Why do that at all? For setting up the part? Like, if the cat was doing it, that'd be amazing.
So the idea. So this is another one where the plot gets a little unnecessarily convoluted. Because this one also uses the same device of a killer that's randomly going around killing people, and it has nothing to do with the main characters whatsoever, except to cast suspicion on the main character.
Which is a bold plot point to A, do once, but B, to repeat it just like a year later.
But also in this one, it's like halfway into the movie as well. Like the whole rest of the movie, you're like, oh, that person was just killed by the gal who we saw at the train station backing out for some reason to expose her rear end, who has a doll collection, a creepy doll collection, a prostitute. And then, yeah, she kills the killer. The killer only kills one person, right? Like that killer only kills one person.
So he kills the girl from the bookstore. Her name is Fosta. So her name was Daniela Giordano. She was Miss Italia, by the way. And so she gets killed, and then the prostitute gets killed, and then the guy who he's the bookstore owner, he gets killed while killing the prostitute. So yeah, it's just kind of shoved in there to give us a couple, you know, extra murders, it seems like, in a movie that's about self-destructive behavior. But it does. When the prostitute gets killed, though, we do get a really great shot because she's killed and she's dragged down the stairs, and then there's that shot of like her feet dragging down the stairs.
Oh, that is amazing.
Yeah, that's a great shot. So that's again a real dynamic, you know, kind of filmmaking in this particular film compared to the other one. Again, it's in there. It's just like a device of some sort. I mean, because typically, if it were an American film. You know, to use this plot device, you obviously have the husband who's killing these prostitutes, so it would look like his wife was killed by the same serial killer, but then the serial killer obviously would never kill again.
Yeah.
But in this movie, in both of these movies, just kind of like, no, there really is just this random serial killer guy. I mean, if I were to submit that script today, I'm getting a note from the producer saying, dude, why is there just this random killer? I'm going to have to say, have you seen Strange Vice of Miss Ward, sir?
Jack, as you're listening to this editing, make sure you stay out of Italy. There are a lot of serial killers there.
apparently.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you go to the glove store and buy a pair of black gloves, you will be put on a watch list in Italy. Big El Brothero is watching you.
So the whole movie. So she, yeah, they're burying people in a wall,
as one does.
And how the cat gets in there? The cat, who's the bane of the wife's existence, and who. To whom she's taken scissors and poked out its eye, and the bottle collection lady sees this animal abuse, and that's her downfall. Her downfall is that she didn't kill the cat.
I love a bottle collecting lady in rural Italy, because I live in an urban place, so we have people going through our bottles all the time because it's like a city. How many miles does she put on that bike? Going to all those different places. She must be in great shape.
Well, gosh, she's really only got to go to one for as much as the people were drinking in that house.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. You got any more of those J&B bottles? It's like, yeah, how many do you need? I just picked some up yesterday.
Another movie in Vienna was decorated with like space age NASA stuff. This movie uses J&B bottles to decorate.
It is almost a staple of giallo films.
Is it?
It is. It's like whenever they're going to be drinking some form of whiskey, it's usually a J&B bottle. And then again, I think that's an attempt to like Americanize it to a certain extent. Something recognizable.
Yeah, they are in there enough. You almost wonder if it was some sort of product placement, but this was before that was a thing. It was just...
Well, I don't know, because when I watch this again, there's some vodka that she's giving the detectives, I believe. And when she sets the bottle down, she intentionally turns the bottle so the label is actually facing the camera before she goes back and gives the drink to the detectives. I was like, wait, this is early product placement?
I bet they probably traded it for actual booze. They say, hey, we'll put your J&B or your vodka in here. All we need is a couple cases of it, and that's as far as it went.
Yeah. So, yeah, I thought that was interesting. I was like, wow, this looks like early product placement, because she intentionally turns it like about a quarter of a turn just to make sure that the label can be read. And it has nothing to do with the plot at all.
No. So there is the lesbian scene between the wife and the niece. And it's one of the least convincing lesbian scenes possibly ever put on film.
That's another staple of these giallo films. Like girl on girl action is definitely they didn't shy away from it at all. It's in quite a few of these. So Edward Finesse. I mean, she the short haircut here is looks really really good on her.
Yeah, that's like new mom hair. Was she a new mom at that point?
I think somebody asked. Oh no, I'm sorry. That was the cousin in the previous film. Like she had a Karen cut or something, or the Rachel or something. She had a very 90s cut.
No, I mean she looks so. It looks like she dropped like maybe 12, 15 pounds. She's got this haircut. That short haircut I think looks really good on her. She's wearing boots in every single scene in this movie. The style that they put on her is just absolutely perfect throughout. And it really just all looks really, really good as she's playing this character who's become, sort of like a puppet master, at least she thinks she is, throughout this movie. I mean, she has a completely different attitude between the two films. It just really is a stark difference between the two. Yeah, as far as like, you know, her getting it on with Anita Strindberg, they actually don't show us the second time, right? It starts and then they cut away from it, so we don't see it again. But yeah, it's not as detailed as some of the other ones that.
No, we get James Connelloni, whatever his name is, with the wide shoulders. He gets more than the two most objectively attractive people.
Well, I mean, Edward gets it on with everybody in this movie. Right, except she gets it on with, except the cat. I mean, she gets it on with the grocery delivery boy, the motocross boy, and then she gets it on with the abusive alcoholic writer. She gets it on with the abusive alcoholic writer wife. I mean, she's like Marilyn Monroe up in there when the pizza boy shows up. I mean, it's just,
I'm surprised she didn't go for necrophilia.
Well, I mean, there was a nice little cozy place behind the wall in that giant wine barrel. Yeah, this one was just a bit nastier as far as I just, all these people, they all ended up getting caught or killed. So it was, I guess, good because I didn't really want anyone to survive.
And I think that's what makes it interesting, especially compared to Miss Ward, because it, yeah, they're all awful people. This one gets really sordid. Because they're all awful people. I mean, this, and so this is the classic, you know, studio notes, like, well, who am I rooting for in this movie? Well, you think you're rooting for the wife until it's revealed that she was the ultimate puppet master the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
So it is difficult in that there's no character you identify with, because even when you think you're supposed to be rooting for the wife, you're like, okay, why aren't you just leaving this guy? You know, he's threatening your life and he's abusive. He's humiliating you in front of the hippies, you know? So why don't you just leave? So you can't really necessarily identify with her, but you are kind of rooting for her, that you're kind of hoping that she and Edwidge are going to team up, which they do, to get rid of the husband. But, it's really just this story about awful people just, you know, imploding on themselves. Yeah.
And a fucking annoying cat. The most annoying cat. And every time they cut to the whatever the cat is, a gun close-up of the cat with the gouge out, I'm like, I don't need to see that. And you accompany that with the worst sound imaginable. I don't know. Fuck cats. Sorry. Do we want to go do some Letterboxd reviews of this film, gentlemen?
Sure.
Wash My Coat Butt gave it 3 stars and said, "Gently Before She Dies. Now that's what I call a cold open." True enough. And then we have,
Here's one. "We went to my husband's birthday a few days ago and it was so rad. From the moment we walked into locked room, the employee there..." Oh, wait. No, this is for locked room and escape rooms in Portland. I'm sorry.
Cherry gave it 2 stars and said, "Society would be vastly improved if I got Shudder instead of tracking these old movies down on the darkest catacombs of the internet." Shudder is sponsoring our episode this week, so that's a good coincidence.
True story.
Uh-huh. Yep. And then finally, KYK, not me, didn't give any stars, but did give it a heart for liking it, says, "I watched this while eating beef patties at 3 a.m., and I probably let out a shriek or two. That cat is all sorts of fucked up." I don't know what the beef patties had to do with it and why it was plural, but I hope you're feeling better.
Yeah. So for our previous director, we just covered Paul W.S. Anderson, right?
Uh-huh.
And in the 4x4s, we get to have that director come in and punch up the movie.
Easiest layup ever. I mean, every time someone goes at Edwidge for a straight razor, she just does a backflip and the camera's looking from above as she jumps over him.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking like in Miss Vaughn, Miss Vaughn, whenever her friend's out walking outside of the, whatever that area is in Vienna, and through the forest right before she, like, for some reason she has to go through the forest to find the groundskeeper to tell her where to go. All of a sudden Scorpion shows up and like throws that thing at her. And then she does the slow motion flip. Of course. John, who we see like in the bathroom, but then we see later in the film. Wouldn't that be amazing if he was a clone like Alice?
Ooh, there you go.
Afterwards, he also walks away with her. He just keeps showing back up. Put another quarter in the machine.
If Finesse at the end of The Strange Vice of Mrs. Ward on the side of the road, if she was all decked out in a leather catsuit, that also might have been appropriate as well.
I'd
absolutely.
Down. Yeah, I know you would, Eric.
So the score here is by Bruno Nicolai. So it's a really good Bruno Nicolai score. Bruno does like a lot of the scores that I think are just great Italian giallo scores. And a lot of these films really rely on their score for setting the environment, especially the time period. Mm-hmm. Especially like when they're downtown and you're getting some really great shots of, you know, 1960s, 1970s Italy. And it really looked like a happening time period. So I like this movie quite a bit just because it is about awful people doing awful things. And, you know, and then the black, based on Edgar Allan Poe's Black Cat, you know, I'm a huge Edgar Allan Poe fan. It almost seems kind of token-ish. I mean, that it is, but it's not, even though it plays into the themes of the Black Cat. But the Black Cat just seems like kind of a cheap plot device as to how she's eventually undone.
It ties the room together.
Imagine if that cat, that one-eyed cat, climbed into a statue and then became feline. And his attack move and clawed like a claw pounce and then like barfing up its food for its fatality and then meowing when you wanted to go to sleep. Wouldn't that be amazing?
Thank that you, would be Anderson. Amazing. The next Mortal Kombat. I love it.
So a couple little trivial factoids on Sergio for this is that Edward Finesse was actually married to Sergio Martino's brother.
Luciano. Yeah, his brother-in-law's. He was producer. Her brother-in-law. Yeah.
And then George Hilton, who appears in a lot of Martino films, was actually married to Sergio's cousin. So there's a lot of family elements here that come into play. And again, working with the same people over and over, and then they become actual family. So,
and then we will see a couple more of those next week, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Which two are we watching? Torso and Death of a Minor?
Yes, okay. Suspicious Death of a Minor and Torso. Torso really leans into the whole hippie movement thing quite a bit. Almost annoyingly so, but he used that as fodder quite a bit. And it's probably the most... There are some elements in this movie that really, really work. So we'll talk about it. And then there's some that are like a little cringy, you know, kind of like these two. But I think it's actually a really good giallo film. And it's probably one of the more famous giallo films that are non Argento, Bava, and Fulci.
Okay.
It's one that people are pretty familiar with, I think.
I'm excited to watch both of the next movies. It was fun watching these movies. Thank you for bringing Sergio Martino as the final lap of this 4x4. It's been a nice change of pace.
Yeah, thanks,
Eric. Yeah. I hope people will check them out because they're entertaining. I think they're great examples of giallo films. And I think they both give you both the why people like giallo films and also shows you how far we've come considering filmmaking and some of the portrayals that we have.
Yeah, it's been a delight. I'm looking forward to the next two. Thanks again to a Weird AI for a theme song. Thanks again to Jack, who is somewhere in France as we speak, and will hopefully be able to start editing our podcast again. Otherwise, we are just putting this out into the ether. all our links, social media links, are on the show notes. Thanks for listening, Eric. Thank you. And, we will talk to you next week. I am going to go buy some gloves and a straight razor, Thomas.
Ciao.
All right. See you guys.
See ya.
Bye.